Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, our seed corn, education. We have for you the leaders of two public universities serving the central and eastern Kentucky regions, also a citizens group that is making what it calls a big, bold ask of Kentucky's legislators now in their biennial budget session in Frankfort. We'll begin close to home. David McFadden was recently named interim president of Eastern Kentucky University, filling the role Dr. Michael Benson resigned from effective January 6th. David has been Senior Vice President for Operations and Strategic Initiatives at EKU, and here's what that means. It means he is responsible for programming and operations at EKU's regional campuses, student life, EKU athletics, dual credit, conferencing and events, communications and brand management, community relations, Model Laboratory School, Student Government Association, the Center for Entrepreneurship and Economic Development, Regional Stewardship, the Center for Workforce Development, and last but not least, WEKU. But wait, there's more. He also has been leading EKU's legislative and policy agenda at all levels of government. So honestly, how do you sleep?
Well, I don't sleep, Tom.
I would only believe it. I mean, I count 14 responsibilities there. Many of them are primary responsibilities. I just wondered, are you one of these people that's able to compartmentalize?
I think, Tom, the key for me is surrounding yourself with good people.
Uh-huh.
Yes, there's a level of responsibility for all of those things. But as you name each one of those areas, there was a face that popped into my head, an outstanding leader or group of leaders who are doing phenomenal work for EKU. And really, it's about those individuals, supporting them, being the resource for them to ensure that they can be successful in their own right.
Before we go further, a little bit of background. Where's home? Where are you from?
Originally, I'm from Paintsville, Kentucky, over in far eastern Kentucky, first-generation college student, but that's home, so I've lived here in Richmond, Kentucky for the better part of the last 20-plus years, so I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else, but a native eastern Kentucky, and I will always be.
You bring a very well-rounded experience into the university's top leadership role. Are you a candidate for that position?
I think right now, Tom, we're focused on the work at hand. There's a lot of work to do. We're excited about that work. I will say that in having conversations with the board, that my service as the interim will not preclude me from participating in the search process, and I look forward to them working through that process in the coming days and weeks and months ahead, and seeing where my candidacy plays out with that process.
Are you still taking the lead in government relations?
So Ethan Witt, who came on board a couple of years ago, Ethan is our director of government and community relations. He's doing a phenomenal job. It's hard for somebody who's been involved in the work in Frankfort for the last 20 years to not be involved directly, but Ethan is taking the point on that. I'll be there to support him in the role as anyone would in a presidential role. We will work very closely together and make sure that we're advocating for Eastern and doing all we can for higher education in Kentucky.
Well, you certainly have been in those trenches in Frankfort, and I'm just wondering how that experience informs how you will proceed as interim president.
I think that, as we look at this legislative session being a budget year, while the overall impact of the university's budget from state appropriations has been in decline for the last decade, there's no doubt about it. The investment that the Commonwealth of Kentucky makes in Eastern is the first dollar in, and it's the most important dollar that we get. And so we are encouraged with conversations we're having with the executive branch, with the legislative branch. We're excited about EKU's performance and the performance funding model. I think there's a lot of policy initiatives that are on the table, funding included, to be talked about in the coming biennium and in the coming years, that I think that my expertise in that space will be very helpful as Eastern navigates those waters.
Those cuts in higher education funding that Kentucky has experienced in recent years have been some of the deepest in the whole country. And state funding is at a premium, as we all know. There's the pension crisis and so many demands on that budget. Many of our regional universities are now functioning on shoestring budgets. How much longer can these circumstances go on?
Well, I think that, Eastern has been here as Eastern Kentucky University since 1906. We find our roots all the way back to 1874. We will continue and we will persevere. I do hope that Kentucky as a state starts to reverse that trend. The biggest challenges we find in many ways is really the talent pipeline. As we think about recruiting exceptional faculty and staff and retaining them here at the university, one of the biggest challenges we face in these downturn economies and a lack of resources is retaining that talent. And we make an immense investment in them. They make an investment in us. And so we hate to see that talent leaving this state. You're right. Kentucky does have some inherent challenges as a state of 4.5 million people who we are challenged with a lot of crises that are put in front of us today, whether it be the opioid crisis that we're seeing that's not only impacting Kentucky, but really the whole nation. As we think about Medicaid and corrections, and we think about K-12 and the needs that they have, carving out a space for higher ed and trying to grow that has been challenging. So we need to see this state grow. We need to see it grow in knowledge workers. We need to see it grow in economic prosperity. And we think the universities are a unique way to achieve that. I would argue that the public universities across the Commonwealth of Kentucky are one of the greatest economic engines that our state can have. And as we think about this university graduating nearly 4,000 students a year who are going out of here trained to be professionals in different fields, from occupational therapy to nursing to education to business to law enforcement, that can drive an economy and that can drive a community. And so we're excited about being a part of that work.
Sometimes it seems as though that link between economic development and higher education gets lost in all the chaos that surrounds the pension crisis, for example. But can we talk about economic development while diminishing our funding of higher ed?
Well, I think we would be short-sighted not to, Tom. Inherently, our universities are large employers in our state. We are producing a workforce that, as we think about those businesses that want to move to Kentucky, are looking for talented workforce, people who are effective communicators, critical thinkers, they can solve complex problems. I think any business you talk to out there say, hey, those are essential skills. And when we talk about those essential skills, we believe the universities are a big part of that. Now, does everyone need a college degree? The answer to that is likely no. But we think that there is definitely a place in the marketplace to continue educating Kentuckians, continuing trying to import individuals from other states and other places across the world into Kentucky and let them be a part of our communities and help our communities grow. And that's going to be the fabric of success for Kentucky, in my opinion. We can look at all the demographic information. We see a downturn in the population coming. We know the number of 18 to 24-year-olds is going to continue to decline for the better part of the next 7 or 8 years. So how are we going to fill those seats? How are we going to grow our economy? How are we going to create the worker of tomorrow? We're going to have to try to bring individuals in from outside of our communities and outside of our state.
You mentioned earlier that you're a first-generation EKU student. A good proportion of this university students are first-generation, first in their families to go to college. It's a significant proportion. Does EKU have a particular sense of mission with regard to first-gen students?
Tom, we absolutely have a mission field there to do the work with our first-gen students. Today, nearly 40% of EKU student body still the first in their family to go to college. If you look at our low-income students, our first-generation students, our students who are at risk, we're talking upwards of 60% of our student body. We are a school of opportunity, and I think that opportunity starts with trying to make sure that those students, those individuals, know that there can be a better tomorrow. And we think education is that thing that can provide that pathway. And so we are purposefully focused on that. It's who we have been. It is the legacy of who we are as an institution. It's a foundational building block, and we will build on that. And we understand that is truly what can shape a generation. When we think about our service region, when we think about Eastern Kentucky, we know that if we can help provide that opportunity for education for one of those individuals, the impact it will have, not just on their lives, but of their children and their children's children, will be second to none. Nothing can match the impact of education.
I've wondered lately if higher ed is basically chasing the job market, keeping pace with the demands of an ever-evolving job market due in particular to technology, to ensure that a degree received years from now is still relevant and in demand by the time that student is graduated.
Well, I think, Tom, that there's certain things that are never going to change, right? Good writing, the ability to communicate,
right,
the ability to solve complex problems. That's at the core of an EKU degree. So you can rest assured whether that student is leaving here with a degree in occupational therapy, aviation, nursing, education, they're going to be able to do those critical core things. What we've got to make sure of is that we are staying relevant and caught up with industry. And the one thing about us as an institution, I think, that is encouraging is so many of our programs are accredited and certified by outside agencies. And we do a phenomenal job, and our faculty do a phenomenal job of staying up to date, making sure that our students are ready to go out into the workforce and they're ready to go to work. A hallmark of EKU, and while I was a student here and it's still the case now 20 plus years later, is those internships and those co-ops and putting our students out into the workforce before they graduate so that they've got a body of work to say, not just what I know, but here's what I can do. Mm-hmm. And I think that is truly a hallmark of an EKU degree.
Because of its name, this may seem obvious, but what would you say is your take on Eastern Kentucky University's role in Appalachian Kentucky?
I think that our role is to be a support to those communities, to best understand what their needs are and try to meet them where they are and to meet those needs, to be a thought leader, to be that light on the hill, to say that anything is possible. And I think in many ways, when we look at the communities of the coal fields and the traumatic impact we've seen economically on the downturn in the coal economy, a recession that hit in 08, and in many ways, some of those communities have not rebounded, we've got to be part of the solution. I think that the notion of admiring the problem, reporting on the problem, understanding the problem is important. Those are all important things, but we better be part of the solution. And so for me, as I sit in the position I'm in today, leading this institution, we are going to be acutely focused on being a part of that solution.
Any idea when the Board of Regents will conclude the search for a permanent president?
Yeah, I'm not sure at this point in time. I think that a conversation with our board chair, vice chair, one of those individuals could probably add some clarity to that. But I know that it'll be a process that will engage all stakeholders on campus, off campus, and they're going to do everything that needs to be done to make sure they find the right leader for EKU moving forward. For me, Tom, Eastern's a part of who I am. It's in the fabric of who I am as a person, and I want the best for Eastern. So whatever that process is, our office will do everything that's needed to support it and look forward to moving forward.
Dr. David McFadden, Interim President, Eastern Kentucky University, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
University of Kentucky President Eli Capiluto has stopped by Eastern Standard. Welcome, Dr. Capiluto.
Thank you. It's always a delight to be with you.
And you are the very busy president of a major university, 30,000 students, 12,000 staff, 2,000 faculty. You preside over what, in effect, is a small city within a larger city, Lexington. So I'm wondering, out of all that, what makes your short list of concerns and issues?
Well, let me first of all say I get great comfort in that responsibility because I have a wonderful team, and I'd want to start with a salute to them. Mm-hmm. We are a small city. We have that many students, but, you know, we have 43,000 hospital admissions a year, nearly 2 million ambulatory visits. So we got lots of people on our campus, and we have a great team that provides excellent service. But on top of my priority list today, we're going into a legislative session. We have a $2.1 billion capital campaign called Kentucky Can. We were thrilled last year to have competitive success in being awarded one of four National Institutes of Health grant, our Healing Communities grant, where we have come up with a plan to reduce opioid deaths by 40% in 3 years. And finally, it's time to think anew about how we breathe new life into our strategic planning, which in turn, we hope, breathes even newer and fresher light into the Commonwealth, because that's why we are here.
And what would that capital campaign fund?
So we have a variety of initiatives. Certainly, we start with talent, both faculty talent and student talent that we want to attract to our university, and these funds are crucial. We also have so many well-deserving students who have worked hard who don't have full access to an education because of cost. And to have endowments, the fund programs like our LEAD scholarship program, which reduces the amount of unmet need, and we now know after 3 or 4 years of implementation, it has a great impact on student success, those kinds of efforts. Recently, we received a $20 million gift for our College of Law, and that focuses on students, faculty, and programming. We have capital needs. Bill Gatton certainly has been one that in the past few years extended his support such that we could build the Gatton Student Center without initiating another student fee, which is typically how these are financed. So that's a sample of some of the things we're able to do through a capital campaign.
You mentioned that the 2020 session of the legislature is underway, and there is discussion about education, of course. Our state's cuts in higher education over recent years have been among the deepest in the whole country. And with state funding at a premium, lots of demands on state funding, many of our regional universities now functioning on shoestring budgets. I was wondering how the regionals and the big land-grant universities like UK can play nicely in that same budgetary sandbox.
The presidents met as recently as yesterday. I've been here nearly 9 years, and I found myself as the senior president amongst that group. I would have to say since I arrived here, though, there has been among the presidents and I think a university a recognition of the universality of how much better our state can be if we have more individuals with a college degree. So that certainly is a common and unifying goal. We have similar challenges, but certainly our comprehensive universities face something unique in terms of growing pension costs. Nonetheless, we tend to agree on an agenda. The last legislature and administration focused on performance funding. That was a plan hatched by university presidents, the Council on Post-Secondary Education leadership, legislative leadership. Those things are hard to do, but those focus on undergraduate education, which is what we all do. The University of Kentucky, University of Louisville have more of a research mission and have more professional programs, medicine, dentistry as examples. But the performance funding focuses on what's common to all of us, really student success.
And how is it changing things?
At the University of Kentucky, it's really been our North Star. Hmm. We did this for the right reasons, knowing that a better educated Kentucky serves us all well. And there are metrics within that performance funding model that incentivize what you do in moving students more quickly through their education, getting more to the finish line, closing the gaps amongst those who are from underrepresented minorities and those from low-income families. I'm pleased to say, if you look over the last several years, the growth, and we've had good growth in Kentucky, in the number of graduates from underrepresented minorities and low-income families, well over 70% of the growth of those degrees in both categories are a result of the efforts at the University of Kentucky.
Last summer, the university's Board of Trustees approved a $4.2 billion budget that eliminated the tuition differential between upper division, junior and senior, and lower division undergraduate students, and that resulted in a slight decrease in tuition for freshmen and sophomores in the current academic year, and then tuition increases for the remaining undergraduate students were the lowest in more than 30 years. We're in austere times, and again, in terms of our state funding, how were you able to achieve this?
We have had success in growing the number of students that come to the University of Kentucky. Volume certainly makes a difference, and I think we've been able to maintain the preparedness we expect from our students, entering students, but also the quality of what we provide, able to graduate more students in a shorter amount of time. With that, we have been very strategic in the way we support our students. If you're a Kentuckian, you fill out a FAFSA form, which is usually something that families in need of financial support make as an opportunity. They complete that form. You can qualify for federal support. We also augment that support through other grants and scholarships. If you take the entering class of Kentuckians last year and I think the past several years, for the last 3 years, the net tuition cost for those groups has gone down. And that is because we have invested in our LEADS scholarship program, which is based on closing the gap in unmet need, which is the total cost of attendance minus your grant scholarships and loans. So we invested in those, and we use analytics to make certain that we stretch a dollar wisely and invest prudently. And we've had good payoffs.
You mentioned solid enrollment, but I want to run a national trend by you. This may not be specifically local, but it's still out there. Something like a 250,000 fewer students enrolled in college than a year ago, according to the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. Higher ed is experiencing a declining high school population, and we hear that quite a bit. That would seem to present you and other campus leaders with significant implications for near future enrollment and growth. Is that the case, and how are you planning for it if it is?
That's commonly referred to as the demographic cliff. It's the fact that we're having fewer babies now than we had, fewer babies 20 years ago than we had prior to this. And that's been the case in Kentucky as well. There's a higher percentage of that smaller group going to college, which is a mitigating trend. But nonetheless, you're correct. That heightens the competition through our investment in talent, that's our faculty, and infrastructure, some $2.5 billion in the last 7 years in our campus. We believe that we've been able to weave together quality programming that makes us successful in a competitive environment.
Some are questioning whether a college education is worth the investment, and for many, the years of student loan debt that they have to carry. How are you able to keep pace with the demands of a job market that evolves as rapidly as today's in order to ensure that a degree earned years from now remains relevant and in demand?
That's a great question. We like to say we want to teach students how to think rather than just what to think. Mm-hmm. It is the case that people believe you're going to have more than several jobs in your lifetime today. You're going to have to be able to critically think, analyze, work in teams, communicate effectively, adapt as you evolve through your career or choose a new career. We think our curricula focus on that skill set, those competencies that'll serve you for a lifetime. We do know that the value of a college degree, while there are some public opinion surveys that indicate growing doubts, data show that you're going to earn probably well over $1 million more in a lifetime than if you just have a high school degree. We know that the vast majority of jobs created coming out of the last recession were those that were obtained by those with a college degree. We know from a variety of surveys and deep research that the quality of your life, how healthy you are, your happiness, a variety of dimensions are much improved amongst those who have a college degree.
Okay, let's turn to faculty. The Chronicle of Higher Education recently published an essay that pointedly questioned the rise of the adjunct, contingent faculty, at the expense of permanent full-time professors. What's the University of Kentucky's ratio of full-time or tenured faculty versus part-time or contingent faculty?
Before I arrived at the University of Kentucky, I think we had moved towards faculty employment that offered continuity for our students. We've moved away from those sort of part-time or temporary positions. I don't have the exact numbers, but it is important to a student to have familiarity year after year during their educational experience, and we've tried to align our employment in that way.
That essay suggests a need to make faculty stability a visible, influential metric that signals a high-quality education so that, for example, students and their parents can determine if a contingent writing instructor, for example, who's teaching six courses per semester at three different colleges, is the same kind of resource as a tenured English professor teaching two or three courses with a stable office and a research budget. What are your thoughts on that proposition?
I would agree that those are probably some good proxies for quality. I think there are others that we should pay attention to. I think investing in how we can better teach and students can better learn is something that's been an emphasis at the University of Kentucky before I arrived. We have a center that provides a rich set of courses and what I would call continuous quality improvement initiatives so that regardless of where you are in your tenure, you could be a senior professor. There are new issues that you have to deal with in a classroom today. Some that center around those things that are starting to divide us, differences in our stories, our histories, our identities. How you deal with that in a classroom is not something a professor may have learned when they got their doctorate 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So it's certainly important to have the continuity. It's certainly important to have a reasonable teaching load, class sizes. But you also have to have other initiatives that maintain the quality of teaching and learning.
Let's turn back to grants and research in particular. I remember 15, 20 years ago, there was often expressed aspiration that the University of Kentucky increase its posture and its renown as a research institution. And it looks to me like that's coming to fruition, especially that grant that you cited earlier having to do with the research into opioids.
This past year, Tom, the awards we received total some $417 million. Those are extramural awards that we must go out and compete against the very best. That's up 25% in a year. Again, it's back to talent, faculty that you can recruit and retain, and infrastructure. A perfect example of that is our Healthy Kentucky Research Building we did in partnership with the General Assembly and Governor. That facility has been a magnet for people who are looking for quality space. We've also been successful in garnering grants that leverage our capacity, but also deal with what confronts Kentucky in difficult ways, one being high rates of cancer. We're one of the, we're the only National Cancer Institute designated center in the state, one of about 60 in the country. And that didn't happen willy-nilly. I always like to tip my hat to those who came before me. They started that planning, Dr. Todd, Dr. Karp, for example. That was a goal of theirs. I happened to be here when it came into fruition, and we've continued to augment what we do there, and we've identified other areas that are priorities for us. So I'm very encouraged. As I said, these grants that we are awarded, you go up against the very best in the country. Our success rates indicate that we're doing pretty well.
You know, an interesting aspect of grants like that one to me has to do with the social and the community impact of a grant like that. The kind of people that are brought to town by a grant like that, that we're standing in line with at the grocery store and don't even realize that we're standing behind perhaps a world-renowned researcher or scientist. But it does have that effect on the community, doesn't it?
I believe so, and I have to salute our community. Many of these investigators could go anywhere, but they find Lexington and Kentucky welcoming. They sense the belonging that I think is characteristic of our community. So I thank everyone that adds to the quality of life we enjoy.
One final question for you, and this is a fun one. We've talked about some serious issues here, but I just always enjoy asking people what they like about their jobs. What is it about your role that gives you joy?
I guess the vicarious experiences, seeing our students cross the stage and shaking their hands at graduation. I received a note this week from a father who reminded me of his child's struggles while they were in college. That was a hand I had the honor of shaking at our May commencement. It reminded me of how our faculty came together to support that student at a difficult time. Those give you immense joy. And then to stand shoulder to shoulder with our investigators or our care providers, the talent we have in the arts, when they're recognized, or to see the faces of those they serve or those who are entertained or those whose souls are moved or stirred. Those are the vicarious experiences that give me extreme delight and make me even more appreciative for the role that I am honored to hold in Kentucky.
University of Kentucky President Eli Capiluto, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break.
Simply put, the consequence of failure is that Kentucky goes back to being at the bottom of the barrel in education outcomes nationally.
The Pritchard Committee's Bridget Blom-Ramsey on why the Citizens Group is making what it calls a big, bold ask of Kentucky legislators at a time when the state budget is in crisis. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
In mid-December, in anticipation of the 2020 session of the Kentucky General Assembly now underway, Bridget Blom-Ramsey, Executive Director of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, made what she termed a big, bold ask, $1 billion, and that's with a B, in additional funding between 2021 and 2026 to address critical needs in education from early childhood to post-secondary. She's here to talk to us about it. Greetings, Bridget.
Greetings. Thank you, Tom.
And for those not familiar with it, the Pritchard Committee is an independent, nonpartisan, citizen-led organization that advocates for improved education in Kentucky, early childhood through post-secondary. Is that an accurate description?
It is exactly an accurate description, yes.
Okay.
Underscoring citizen-led. So we are citizens who really care about the future of our state and improving education outcomes as a primary way that we improve the quality of life in the state.
Okay. And as citizens, you're calling on our legislators, on all of us, actually, to summon more of a sense of urgency about improving education in Kentucky. Education is always important, but why the urgency?
Well, the urgency, Tom, because Kentucky's made great progress over the last now almost 35 years in education. In the 1980s, the refrain was, thank goodness for Mississippi, because Kentucky was at the bottom of the national rankings in all indicators of outcomes in education. But today we find that we're roughly middle of the pack, depending on what indicator you look at. So we've made a lot of progress, but we're not where we want to be, and we're not where we can be based on the fact that Kentucky is proven we can make big leaps in improvement. So if we want to make it to the top tier of all states, other states are chomping at our heels as we're sitting kind of middle of the pack and beginning to fall behind. And it's time for the state to really bring the investment behind the urgency to help us take the next giant leap to the top tier.
Okay, and you're calling on the legislature to put $1 billion on the table over 6 years.
$1 billion over 6 years.
To move forward with some key investments. What would they be?
So the key investments, and this is really important, we're looking at the entire education pipeline, early childhood, beginning with childcare, through post-secondary education. Because we know oftentimes we have to make trade-offs as a state. Our General Assembly has to make trade-offs in the budget. And many times we fund something at the expense of something else. A great example is the cuts to higher education. Over the last almost decade, 33% decrease in funding to higher education, at the same time that Tennessee, our longest border state, has increased investment in education by double digits. So we recognize that we've got to invest in the entire pipeline, beginning with childcare through higher ed. And we know we can't do that in one budget session. It would be impossible to really increase investment that way in one budget session. So we put together a six-year framework for thinking about how we would increase investment in such a way that we're able to also measure the outcomes of that investment. So beginning in this next budget session through three cycles to 2026, increasing investment by $1 billion in three buckets: early childhood, childcare and preschool, K-12 with strategic priorities there, and higher education, all with the goal of increasing education outcomes and education attainment of Kentuckians that will result in a better quality of life.
To put this into further context, my understanding is that Kentucky's cuts in higher education funding over recent years have actually been among the worst in the nation.
Yeah, so I think Kentucky tried to maintain its investment in K-12 education through the Great Recession, beginning in about 08 and through Governor Beshear Sr.'s administration. But there were cuts to early childhood, cuts in the child care space in particular, which has eroded our ability to provide the type of child care that working families need and that young children need to be ready for success in school. And we also eroded our investment in higher education. At a time when Kentucky is fifth from the bottom of the nation in poverty, and we've been languishing there for years. So while we've made these gains in education, particularly in K-12 education, we lag the nation in post-secondary outcomes. And to move the needle on poverty, we need to help more of our Kentuckians achieve marketable degrees and certificates that really give them entry into the workforce of the future.
Are you suggesting that these stepped-up investments be made incrementally over the six-year period?
So across the – what we're suggesting is that across – look at the entire pipeline and incrementally make investments across that entire pipeline over the next three biennia. So additional investments in all of those areas in this upcoming budget session, which would be the next two-year budget, and then bump up again in the second biennia budget, and then again in the third. And that would get us to that billion-dollar increase across the board in all of those areas to support outcomes across the pipeline.
Okay. Among the programs that you would like to see receive improved funding, which do you think have the greatest potential to actually deliver positive results?
All of them have the potential to deliver positive results. But our next big play for the state, Tom, is has to be really thinking about that reinvestment in post-secondary education. In 2017, the legislature passed a performance-based funding model for higher ed, which has resulted in increased attainment and increased success for students across the board, particularly students we've historically left behind. And in Kentucky, again, a state that's high in poverty, poverty, a state with many first-generation college goers. Supports for students to persist and be successful in college, ultimately toward that degree, is critical. So that performance-based funding model is working. It's resulting in higher attainment for all students. And we want to see that model fully funded. So that one of the requests is fully funding that performance-based funding model. That's the nearest term way that the legislature could have impact on Kentuckians and the quality of life in Kentucky, is ensuring more Kentuckians have a marketable degree or credential that allows them to compete in today's workforce and the workforce of the future.
I think you've just touched on it and did so earlier, but just to kind of focus on the benefits of this, this ask is of the legislature, but ultimately, really, it's of the taxpayers of Kentucky. What's in it for them?
So that's a great question. What's in it for the taxpayers? We did a poll, an education poll of Kentucky last summer, and it was clear that taxpayers understand the importance of higher levels of education to compete in the job market. It's also clear that they understand the importance of investing in childcare and the availability of childcare for working families. So what's in it for the taxpayers? Increasing the affordability of higher education, so more of our young people and adults can access higher ed and attain those degrees and credentials that are important for them to progress economically, and access to high-quality early childhood programs that benefit their youngsters as well as benefiting working families and the business community. So the business community says there isn't enough supply of childcare such that they're sure their employees have that important work support. So there's a lot in it for taxpayers and the community at large in Kentucky.
We've talked quite a bit about post-secondary funding and so forth. What about the K-12 ask that you're proposing?
The ask for K-12 is kind of the third leg of our stool. And there are two primary components in addition to the fund for teaching excellence. They are fully funding kindergarten and fully funding transportation for our school districts. These are two issues or two areas that local taxpayers are currently picking up the dime for. So almost all districts in the state, minus five or six, currently have full-day kindergarten options for families. The state only pays for half of that. So we're asking that the state pick up the full tab over the next 6 years. Similarly, with transportation, all of our districts are running school buses, and those rural areas are the ones that have the most area to traverse in those school buses. So the lack of state funding for transportation disproportionately impacts those rural and often low-wealth districts. And again, taxpayers are picking up the dime for that expense. So what we're saying is the state needs to pick up the investment. State needs to pick up the check for full funding for kindergarten and for transportation and allow those local dollars that are currently paying for those things to be used for strategic priorities of the district and of that community. And so that's an important piece that taxpayers should understand. It allows them to take their money they're currently investing and use it for strategic priorities locally while the state picks up the investment that it can and should pick up.
Why do we need a fund for teaching excellence?
Teaching excellence, underscoring all of our outcomes in education, is one fact, and that fact is teaching matters. So deepening investment in teaching, in professional learning for teachers, so that they're equipped with the best strategies based on science to deliver the content and the learning outcomes that our students need, is critical for our success as we move forward. Over the past years, funds for teachers for professional learning, for resources in the classroom have been eroded. And so this fund for teaching excellence that we're proposing would allow for investment in professional learning for teachers in strategic priority areas such as reading and math proficiency. So we know we're leaving about half of our kids behind when it comes to meeting proficiency standards in reading and mathematics. That's unacceptable today in 2020. So this fund would allow for that investment in teaching so that teachers have the best strategies based on science and evidence to deliver the content in such a way that more of our youngsters are meeting those proficiency standards as they move forward.
There is a pretty intimidating 900-pound gorilla lurking in just about every room where people are talking about state funding these days, and that is that our budget officials are projecting that Kentucky will collect additional revenue that falls way short of the estimated $1.8 billion in new spending obligations, pension contributions, state prisons, Medicaid, public employee and retiree health insurance, things like that. Considering the dire condition of Kentucky's budget, with no indication that revenue streams are going to be increased or even created, and with the leadership of the state Senate declining to make education funding its top priority for the 2020 budget session, what are the chances that our legislators will come around to committing to these investments?
If we scale all of this back to the core responsibilities of state government, Tom, and there we find education as a core responsibility of our state government, a core responsibility that taxpayers want to see supported, then the natural growth in the general fund would allow for this additional investment over the next 6 years. This additional investment can, and the outcomes of the investment can be measured. So if the natural growth in the general fund will allow for the investment to take place, we submit that it's a core responsibility of state government to invest in this way on behalf of Kentuckians. Other pressures on the budget that you've listed and pressures we've been hearing about for years, like unfunded pension liabilities and some other issues, yes, those are absolutely pressures on our state budget. And just like a family might have to consider, what do you spend money on first and what do you get a second job for to pay off debt or to deal with, we would ask our legislature to think about the state budget in the same way. There's no doubt additional revenue is needed, but the general fund will allow for this additional investment in education, and we may need to, as a state, identify other revenue options to pay down unfunded liabilities and to provide for other issues that the General Assembly finds as a priority.
A moment ago, we touched on what's in it for taxpayers. I'd like to also look at what are the consequences of failing to make these investments?
Well, simply put, the consequence of failure is that Kentucky goes back to being at the bottom of the barrel in education outcomes nationally. So we're already starting to see slippage in our climb to the middle. So a few indicators. 10 years ago, we were 28th for preschool enrollment in the nation. Today, we're at 41st. Just 5 short years ago, we were 8th in the nation in fourth grade reading. Today, we've slipped to 21st. So the gains that we've made in the last 25 years, we're starting to see a slip. And so the sense of urgency and the what will happen if we don't do it should all be about any gains that we've made as a result in Kentucky's economy, in Kentucky's education outcomes. All of that is at risk.
Bridget Blom-Ramsey, Executive Director of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
The Ohio Valley's economy could see slower growth in 2020 amid continued anxiety about trade and possible downturns in both energy and manufacturing. Becca Schimmel spoke with regional economists about what's ahead.
Michael Hicks directs the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University in Indiana, where he forecasts the health of the manufacturing sector. He sees a manufacturing slowdown on the horizon and blames the tariffs levied under President Donald Trump's administration. Hicks predicts the Ohio Valley's economic growth to slow dramatically in 2020.
You will see layoffs, certainly lower hours, less generous bonuses at year end, both this year and next year, less demand for power, which is going to be important, particularly in Kentucky and West Virginia, as manufacturing firms both use less metallurgical coal and less coal for electrical power.
Hicks says Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia economies are heavily dependent on exports, which is why the trade war has and will continue to have a large impact. The USMCA, or the new NAFTA, has passed in the House but is still pending in the Senate. But Hicks says that trade deal doesn't offer much assurance.
It improves the confidence that we're not going to have a trade war with our big partners in Canada and Mexico. But, you know, to just speak candidly, we're always one tweet away from a new adversary in the trade war. And so
of the three states, Ohio's larger economy is also more diverse and follows national trends more closely. In Kentucky, manufacturing plays a significant role in the state's economy. Jason Bailey is the executive director for the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy.
And we've also lost a lot of manufacturing over the last couple of decades across the state in industries like apparel or furniture manufacturing or computer parts manufacturing. That has often been to cheaper locations like China and Latin America.
Bailey says Kentucky still hasn't fully recovered from the last recession, and it's facing a tough year ahead with state budget cuts likely. West Virginia is in a similar boat with even fewer signs of economic recovery. West Virginia University is predicting the state's economy will expand by about 0.2% annually for the next 5 years. That's the lowest rate they've predicted in the past 7 years. Ted Bettner is the executive director of the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy.
You know, since our last economic recession that began in 2007, West Virginia has seen less than a 1% increase in job growth over that time.
Bettner says the downturn in coal has hit hard, of course, but that was somewhat offset by a boost from natural gas and pipeline construction work. But now, one major pipeline project is complete, and some others have been halted by legal challenges. Bettner says that focus on natural resource extraction can hamper other kinds of growth.
And also, a lot of other industries, especially ones based in the knowledge-based economy, don't really want to be around extractive industries. They don't want to be around a lot of pollution.
The U.S. is in the longest period of economic recovery in modern history. Hicks says normally that would mean the country would be running a budget surplus and could start paying off debt or taking on big projects.
We would have made some long-term investments in infrastructure, highways, roads, particularly with transfers to local governments that are, you know, facing a lot of aging infrastructures.
Instead, Hicks says the federal budget has a deficit of more than $1 trillion after tax cuts and what he calls unsustainable federal spending. As economists across the region watch for signs of the next recession, they also look to infrastructure investment as an area for potential growth. The Ohio Valley has massive funding needs for its roads and aging water systems. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and WEKU. On next week's edition, reports that antibiotic companies are going out of business.
Because of the problems with drug resistance, when we do have new antibiotics to the market, we have to reserve those for worst-case scenarios when there's really nothing left to treat the patient with but these new medications. We kind of have to savor those new ones that we do have come to market.
Dr. Bethany Wattles, a clinical pharmacist at the University of Louisville School of Medicine, says this is coming at a time when germs are becoming more and more drug resistant.
It's something that we need to be concerned about, and essentially we need to fix the problem now before it's too late.
And Danny Rogers, a Census Bureau partnership specialist for Central Kentucky, here to tell us about the 2020 headcount, including a need for more census workers.
Specifically, it's $19 an hour. 58 cents a mile reimbursement, weekly pay, and we have full-time jobs available, part-time jobs available, and flexible hours.
These stories and more on next week's edition of Eastern Standard. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.fm or esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.